My name is Keith Beavers, and I would love to thank Beyonce for getting me back into country. Like Carly Pierce? What? What's going on, wine lovers from the Vine Pair Podcasting Network? This is the Wine 101 Podcast. My name is Keith Beavers, and I'm the Tastings Director of Vine Pair, and hi! We are entering a moment in Burgundian history where we start to understand and realize what grapes are important and what aren't, according to very rich people. Let's get into it. So we know now that wine has been produced in the Burgundian region since antiquity. And we also know now that the word Burgundy is just a term for the people that once had a kingdom there, the Kingdom of Burgundy, the Burgundians. And we also know how important the element for the factor of the monk, the monastic element, how important that is in the history of Burgundy and vines and its wines. And now we're starting to see some vineyards emerge with names that we understand today as some of the most famous vineyards in Burgundy and on the planet. And it was the next group of people that existed in this place that ushered in the new era of Burgundy and its wine that will get us to modern times. And those are the Dukes of Burgundy. I just hit my microphone because I got to say, this is messy, guys. The Dukes are messy, messy people. And it's just, there's a lot of history here that I went through, and I was going to do a whole thing on the Dukes, but I'm not, because man, it's hard to hold on to. These dudes did all kinds of weird stuff. So just because it was all political, a lot of political maneuvering and a lot of relationships with the church, as we saw in the last episode with, you know, giving vineyards because they want to save their souls and all this. But let me talk about how the Dukes actually happened. And then we're going to go fast forward to the Dukes that made Burgundy important. The wine part. Okay. After the death of Charlemagne, which basically ended the Carolingian dynasty and the centralism of the French, of France in general, this is where the area of Burgundy becomes partitioned. And now the what was once the Burgundian kingdom, or the Kingdom of Burgundy, is now been absorbed into the Frankish Empire and is now ruled by Frankish king. And because a king can't have all these little kings, there's no more kingdom, he reduces the Burgundy region to a ducal rank or territory. Meaning there's all these different dukes that rule parts of this partitioned once kingdom. And this all happened in the 9th century by King Robert the Pious, the Frankish king. This time in Burgundy is pretty intense because a big power vacuum situation is happening here, where once there was a kingdom and now there's not. And then now things are being partitioned. And the thing about this area, it gets recreated over time during these different eventual dukes. But what it ends up happening here, the dukedom of this area emerges when one of the Frankish kings, Charles the Bald, has a buddy named Guerin of Provence, and they're military dudes. So they really got, I don't know, they had some sort of like camaraderie during military campaigns. And then the king, gives Guerin administrations over multiple counties in this newly partitioned part of France called Burgundy. He's given the counties of Chalons and Nevers, and he appoints his own viscounts as deputies to run his little area, and they start calling him Dukes, D-U-X, which is Latin for leader. Dukes becomes Duke. And this is sort of the origins or the beginnings of what would be the dukedom or the duchy of Burgundy. And it's official in 921 AD when Richard the Justiciar, or just Richard the Just, is recognized as a duke by the king, the Frankish king of the time, ushering in the Dukes of Burgundy. And then a couple things happen here. He's given a bunch of territory, so he has even more counties. And for us as wine lovers, the more important ones are the Beaunois region and Dijonais, which is Beaune and Dijon, among others. And what's really interesting about this moment in time in Burgundy is that I think because the king was like, hey, this place used to be a kingdom, so I'm going to give this place semi-autonomy. And the Ducatus or the Dukes of Burgundy actually had their own law called the Loi Gombette. It was, you know, about marriages and inheritance, just all the laws. It was kind of separate from the rest of France, but it kind of adhered to some of the French law as well, but it was kind of their own thing. And that set this land up for a kind of leadership underneath a king that felt kind of royal in itself. And it's from here that things just go wild. You know, I find it interesting, the royalty of France at this time, through all of these different dukes, we're going to fast forward to the 14th century in a second because it's just crazy, but it's a very small world in the royal world of the Middle Ages in Europe. Everybody kind of knew each other. There, all these rich families were marrying each other, and like power was being transferred back and forth and land was being redrawn. And it's just kind of nuts, but that's just what was happening. Is this long sort of like leadership role of the Dukes of Burgundy. And at one point in the 14th century, oh, and by the way, the monks are still doing what the monks are doing. They're still making wine. And what's interesting is during this entire time in France, the Abbey of Cluny was like, we have immunity from secular overlords. We do not adhere to all the mess that's going around through the entire dukedom. So they just keep on making great wine, and the dukes just fall in love with this wine, and it becomes a status symbol in the Duchy of Burgundy. Around the 14th century, there was a king named King John II of France who actually did not like the fact this area had some independence, but it had been around for so long. So he actually attempted to bring Burgundy under royal rule, and they just said no. And I love the way the history books talk about this. The king, this is a quote, "The king proved unequal to the task of enforcing his policy, which was far beyond his political capabilities." So it seems to me that either the dukes were just that powerful and could not be reined in, or the king actually was just a bad king and he was, I don't know. There's a story about King John II and then how he was actually captured by the enemy at one point in a battle. So maybe he wasn't a very good king. I don't know, but it didn't work. But, you know, John II was a king. He did have power. And although he couldn't get this to work, he had a workaround. A workaround? A workaround. He had a workaround. King John II had a favorite son. His name was Philip the Bold. And the big deal with him is that he went into battle with his dad and he didn't get off the battlefield until the bitter end, which proved something to his dad. It's like, oh, son, I love the fact that you almost died next to me. Thank you. And the one thing kings did do is they invested or appointed dukes. So what does he do? He invests his son as the Duke of Burgundy. Therefore, keeping that place independent with its semi-autonomous Loi Gombette while actually having his son as a duke, therefore, by proxy, ruling over the land of the Duchy of Burgundy. Wow, good workaround. Actually, John dies, and the next king that comes up officially recognizes Philip the Bold as the Duke of Burgundy in 1363, and the Valois Dukes ruled this land until 1477. And it's in this time that something very important happens for wine in Burgundy. A couple things, actually. And again, I'm not sure if it's because of the connection to a king, but it's during this reign of dukes that Burgundy actually flourishes. Actually, the Burgundian state, because now because of its independence, semi-independence and semi-autonomy, it's considered the Burgundian state. So the Burgundian state starts to flourish under the Valois dukes, and it's here we get the first mention of Pinot Noir being talked about by the monks and everybody else. But it's not called Pinot Noir at the time. In 1373, it's documented as Noirien, or Noirien, black but not the Pinot part. So at the time, the wines that are being consumed are this red wine made from Noirien. There's actually Gamay all over the place. It's a very high-yielding variety at the time. It's a high-yielding variety. And also a white wine grape called Fromentux, which we actually mentioned in the Champagne episode. One of the Champagne episodes, this is an ancestor, is thought of as an ancestor of Pinot Gris. So the Pinot family's around, but it hasn't been figured out 100% yet. Philip the Bold, son of a king, in the first generation of four generations of the Dukes of Valois that would be ruling over the Burgundian state, absolutely loved Pinot Noir, or Noirien. He thought it was the bee's knees. Obviously, I mean, Pinot Noir is phenomenal. And back in the day, even though they didn't have modern technology, the wine was probably doing wonderful things because of the systematic improvements of the monks, who were immune from any kind of secular whatever and were constantly being given vineyards from the royalty as they tried to gain favor with the abbey and the vassals and the people in the region. But they didn't call him Philip the Bold for nothing, am I right? Because in 1395, he puts out a very bold, see what I did there? Decree. Declaring, get this, that Gamay, the Gamay grape, is not only harmful to human beings, but the very soil the plant is growing in. This is not true. This is fake news from the Middle Ages. But because people were planting Gamay and making wine out of it and it was just fine. Actually, people thought it was lesser then, but whatever. He didn't want it around. This is where we first find out that Gamay is a high-yielding variety, because documentary evidence states at the time this to be true in the 14th century. And in the same decree, Philip's like, hey, do not use organic fertilizers because it will actually help increase the yields of this vine. That fertilizer was manure. That vine was Gamay. Those two things together made profit. If you have a high-yielding vine in the Middle Ages, you can make a lot of wine from, and you have a livestock that helps you do everything on your farm, you have natural organic manure, you're going to utilize those two things. But Philip the Bold's like, no, don't do it. It's bad for everybody.
I mean, you know, not really.
But really. But this is the thing about Philip the Bold. He was the son of a king. He was royal, so he probably had his own agenda there. But he really was actually trying to create some quality here. And he thought that the Pinot Noir variety actually did better in Burgundy than the Gamay grape. And he was actually correct, because Gamay down in Beaujolais, which we'll probably have to do a quick little supplemental at some point to kind of get a little history there, actually does better down there in the granite soils than the limestone soils of where it was being grown in Burgundy. I don't know if he knew that, but that's pretty cool. And I'm not really sure what month this decree was put out, but he said, I want all this uprooted out of here by next Easter. But wine lovers, it didn't work. The thing is, the Duke is the Duke. He's not the king. And I don't know, maybe there weren't any laws in place in the Loire Gambette for this. Maybe he couldn't put it into the laws, because his grandson, who was a duke in the 15th century, 1429 to 1467, was still yelling at people to get the Gamay out of the ground. So obviously people wanted profit more than they wanted to listen to their duke or multiple dukes. But the grandson, Philip the Good, was he good? I don't know. He didn't like Gamay. I think Gamay's delicious. What's wrong with that? Anyway, Philip the Good had some more fake news for his people. He's like, not only is the Gamay grape an inferior vine, but the vine itself growing in this area is a threat to wine itself and the Dukes of Burgundy, the actual people, the humans. What? And now, I don't know if this is coincidence or not, but it was around this time, and because of this, maybe because of this statement, that Philip the Good's, the grandson of Philip the Bold's chancellor, Nicholas Roland, built the famous Hospice du Bon, which was a hotel that was supposed to help the poor because the plague came around at some point. It was in a hotel, but the Hospice du Bon is a very famous moment during the year in Burgundy where they actually have a charity auction for wine and a whole weekend of celebrations. I mean, a lot of the tradition for the Hospice du Bon and the charity events, stuff like that didn't really happen until the mid-19th century, but still, this is where the actual building was built. And so that's how the Dukes influenced Burgundian wine, which is kind of cool. It isolated Pinot Noir in this area. It's after the Dukes that things really start to get interesting. And it's, well, the Oxford Wine Companion calls the next phase of Burgundy modern Burgundy. That's not 100%, I mean, modern as in like not the Middle Ages. A lot of very, important and interesting things happen in the next phase of Burgundy. But if it wasn't for everything that happened up until now, what happens next may not have been able to happen. I know that sounds a little enigmatic, but when we get to that, next week, when we get to this, you're going to see something very interesting in how this all plays out and how Burgundy emerges as one of the finest wine regions in the world. Okay, I tell you what, let's talk next week. Yeah. Fine Pear Keith is my Insta. Rate and review this podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. It really helps get the word out there. And now for some totally awesome credits. Wine 101 was produced, recorded, and edited by yours truly, Keith Beavers, at the Vine Pear headquarters in New York City. I want to give a big old shout out to co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Mallon for creating Vine Pear. And I mean, big shout out to Danielle Grinberg, the art director of Vine Pear, for creating the most awesome logo for this podcast. Also, Darby Seaside for the theme song. Listen to this. And I want to thank the entire Vine Pear staff for helping me learn something new every day. See you next week.